Major funding for The Pulse is
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Guided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Will you marry me? It's a big question, and beyond the question, with all of its implications, these days it's a moment that tends to be carefully orchestrated. Just watch one of thousands of highly produced engagement videos that people put online. Romantic walks to secluded locations.
I love you so deeply.
Of course, a photographer stalks in the distance.
And
then, pow, down on one knee, out comes the ring with a big diamond. Once the yes, I will portion is over, all the hugging and kissing is done with, then the ring is more closely examined. And now imagine the ring buyer casually says, "It's beautiful, right? It's a lab-grown diamond." A what? It's fake? No, just made in a lab. I mean, look, honey, diamonds take millions of years to form.
In a laboratory, diamonds can be synthesized. That process can be sped up, and instead of millions of years, it can take hours.
So they are cheaper? Sure, yes, a lot, but
on a material level, there's really no difference between them.
This, by the way, is historian Lydia Pine. She has a new book out called Genuine Fakes.
You know, does this get to count as a real diamond? And ought we to think about it as a real diamond?
She says lab-grown diamonds were first made in the 1950s by General Electric, mostly for tools. Eventually, they made their way into the jewelry market with lots of pushback.
They're great to put in drill bits and what have you, but they're not real diamonds. They're not the things that you would put in an engagement ring.
Think about what that diamond is supposed to signify.
Longevity, commitment, and the specialness of each natural diamond.
That's jeweler Bob Hamburger. For him, a diamond has to be mined, not made.
You know, I mean, a real diamond is unique, it's rare, it's one of a kind. It's one of the oldest things on the planet. You know, it's a way you can hold in your hand something several billion years old or hundreds of millions of years old.
Bob works at Steven Singer. That's a jewelry store in Philadelphia. He hands me a diamond and a magnifying glass. I look through it. The diamond comes into focus.
And now I see a little marking in there.
Yes. Okay. So you see a little bit of like, they look like small bubbles,
yes,
little white crystals.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a real diamond, a natural diamond.
Bob says this is what people want for their engagement, something unique, even though lab-grown diamonds are at least chemically the same thing.
Carbon in a crystal lattice structure.
But historian Lydia Pine says for lots of people, the lab-grown aspect is what makes that kind of diamond attractive. One reason, you don't have to worry about where the diamond was mined and if it was done ethically.
Instead of saying, I'm going to feel like I've been had and deceived because this isn't a diamond that was grown in the earth. Rather, consumers are able to say, you know what? I find this other context problematic. I'm going to opt to own or to buy a laboratory-grown diamond because I feel like that's an ethical alternative. And so I think that what's happening with the story of diamonds is that there's this cultural transformation and that with that transformation, we're seeing people becoming more and more open to what gets to count as a quote-unquote real diamond.
So it's the story we tell ourselves about these diamonds that make them, quote, real or fake. If you know exactly what you're getting and you think of it as an alternative, a copy, a replica, then it's not fake, right? On today's episode, what's real, what's fake, and when does it matter? Our Our first story is about fakes that are definitely meant to deceive people. Deep fakes. They are these videos created with a deep learning software, artificial intelligence, basically. And they can make it look like somebody said and did things they didn't. It's super realistic. You could make lots of funny videos with this technology, but also some terrifying stuff that could ruin reputations and lives. Liz Tong went to investigate deepfakes. And a note, if you're listening with kids, there is some explicit content in here.
If you watch Game of Thrones and, like so many others, hated season 8, you may have seen this video. It opens with a real scene from the show. A speech that one of the main characters, Jon Snow, is giving after a big battle to mourn the fallen. But instead of talking about the soldier's sacrifice, Jon Snow says something else.
Time for some apologies. I'm sorry we wasted your time. I'm sorry we didn't learn anything from the ending of Lost. We take the blame. I'm sorry we wrote this in like 6 days or something. Now, let's burn the script of season 8. And just forget it forever.
And with that, we see the beginnings of a bonfire. There, instead of fallen soldiers, is the script for season 8.
Fuck season 8.
So far, the video's racked up more than 2 million views and over 2,000 comments. I tracked down the guy who made the video. His name's Chris Yumi, and he said he knew from the beginning that this video was gonna take off.
I knew it, like, okay, this is gold. This is so, so funny.
Chris is a special effects artist who lives in Belgium. He and some friends run a YouTube channel called Eating Things, where they play around with iconic movie and TV scenes, mostly inserting a sloppy shirtless guy stuffing his face. But Chris says this video has been their biggest hit by far.
When it was crazy, and so many people messaged me and called me, it was amazing.
A lot of the enthusiasm has to do with people's shared hatred of Game of Thrones' 8th season. But it's also an amazing video because it just looks so real. Like, Jon Snow's lips actually match up with these words that he never actually said.
I have more lines in this video than I had in the last season.
This, my friends, is the power of deepfakes.
I got fascinated, like, the technique is really cool. Like, what can we do with it?
Now, there are a few things that you need to make a deepfake. The first is deepfake software. Chris says there's two kinds that most people use, Deepface Lab and Face Swap. So you get the software, figure out how it works. Then you need to find either photos or video or both of the person you're deepfaking. Right now, Chris is working on a video of Borat.
Well, hello, nice to meet you. And my name is Borat.
So what I do is I Google and I find all these high quality videos where I see him talking. I see him in all these different kind of angles.
In Kazakhstan, manners is important.
Once he has all the footage and or photos, he feeds it into the software. And here is where the magic happens. The software uses the footage to actually learn how that person's face and mannerisms work.
I let this deep learning software, I let it run for, like, let's say a week and week and a half. And by then it should have learned how Borat's face looks like when he's talking, how his mouth movement is, how his eyes look like, even the sparkle in his eye.
In America, women can vote, but horse cannot.
If the quality of your source footage is good, it should learn this. And this is done automatically.
Until recently, this kind of effect was something that only high-level special effects studios and academic groups were able to achieve. Remember the 2016 Star Wars film Rogue One? How it ends with a quick scene of a young, computer-generated Princess Leia?
What is it they've sent us?
Hope.
Yeah, that was basically a deepfake. But recently, as in within the last 2 years, that technology has become available to just about anyone who wants it in the form of open source software. And to Hani Farid, a digital forensics expert who teaches at UC Berkeley, that is a cause for concern.
I'm worried about all kinds of things. I'm worried about the video of a candidate for high office being released 24 hours before an election and before anybody figures out it's fake. We've had a manipulation of our democracy. I'm worried about national security issues. These genuinely worry me.
Now, those are some pretty big what-ifs. But the spread of deepfakes has already created victims in reality that aren't in the public spotlight.
My name is Noelle Martin. I'm 25 years old and I live in Western Australia.
Noelle's story begins when she was 18 and engaging in the time-honored tradition of Googling herself.
Like one night, just tried it for myself out of curiosity.
That's when she found that one of her social media photos had been hijacked and distributed among multiple porn sites.
That's when my life changed.
Now, Noelle wasn't some kind of influencer or local celebrity. She was just a pretty and bubbly young woman who liked going out and taking lots of selfies. But that turned out to be a liability when she realized that multiple of her social media photos, along with her name and personal info, had been spread across the online pornosphere.
So I didn't even know what was happening. I'm completely shocked, completely sickened. And then I went down the rabbit hole of looking at all the sites and reading everything. And it just kept getting worse and worse.
What worse meant were deepfakes. After several years of fighting to get the photos and her personal info taken down from these porn sites, Noelle's attacker took it to a new level.
But I got, you know, a message that had links to videos. It was a video of me having sexual intercourse where they took, like, they have my face and it was on a body and they put Noelle Martin in the title.
And then another deepfake video showed Noelle performing oral sex.
And the face used in that video was of me at 17 years old.
Worst of all, everyone, the police, the government, said there was nothing they could do. So Noelle started contacting the websites one by one, trying to get her image taken down. She says the whole experience was like a waking nightmare.
Absolutely horrifically. Like, it was just, it shattered everything. It honestly did. I just had this cloud over my head for, you know, 6-7 years. And I wanted, essentially, like, I wanted to, you know, I did not want to live for a lot of my adult life.
As much as those of us who love deepfakes would like to believe that Noelle's case was an anomaly, it wasn't. In fact, the guy who made deepfakes a thing did it for porn. He's a Reddit user who showed up on the site around 2017. We still don't know who he is. And what he did was take the faces of famous actresses, Emma Watson, Scarlett Johansson, Gal Gadot, and paste them onto the bodies of actresses in existing porn videos. Reddit eventually banned Deepfake and his videos, but by that time, it was too late. He'd made his source code, the magic key to automating this whole process, available to other people, which means that now, it's everywhere.
It turns out to be a very robust and reliable and relatively speaking, simple technology.
That's Sui Liu. He's a professor of computer science at the State University of New York at Albany, and he focuses on digital media forensics.
So he actually published his code as open source software, and everybody, you know, have internet connection, know a little bit about computer programming and machine learning, will be able to run this code and start making fake videos.
Deepfake, the Reddit user, provided not only the software, but the name, which stands for deep learning and, of course, fake.
I think what is dramatic about this is that the machines are essentially doing all the heavy lifting.
That's Hani Farid again. And he says this advancement is mostly thanks to machine learning, a kind of artificial intelligence that uses mathematical models to detect complex statistical patterns in large amounts of data.
The way it's actually generated is there's two computer algorithms. Technically, they're called deep neural networks. And one is a synthesizer and one is a detector. And the synthesizer creates the fake content and asks its counterpart, the detector, whether it's real or not. And they work together in a very tight loop.
In the past, that required hundreds of photos and videos, which meant that deepfakes were really only realistic for people like famous actors or politicians. But in recent years, the technology has been growing by leaps and bounds, which not only means just about anyone can do it, but they can do it with fewer and fewer source photos and videos.
The scary point is it's getting better and better and better and better. You know, and people can use one photo to create these videos. They don't need hours of footage of someone. And they are already starting to look extremely realistic to the point where it's really difficult to detect what is real and what's fake.
But we aren't completely defenseless. Both Hani and Sowei, the digital forensics researchers I talked to, are part of a global network of academics who are working on strategies to try and identify deepfakes. For example, Sowei's team noticed that deepfakes rarely blink, so they came up with a technology that can detect that. The problem is the deepfake creators quickly adapted. As for Hani, his team is tracking people's unique behavioral tics that don't always translate to deepfake videos. But he says that this approach, along with all the others people are coming up with, is likely just a short-term solution.
There is absolutely will come a time where the generation of deepfakes will defeat our forensic techniques. Our hope is that that takes not weeks or months, but years. And in the meantime, we will develop new techniques.
Other people, like Noelle, are pushing for a legal solution. She successfully advocated for laws in Australia that criminalize what's called image-based abuse. And that push is starting to spread. In fact, in the U.S., Congress recently introduced several bills designed to criminalize the creation and distribution of any deepfakes that don't have labeling that makes it clear they are deepfakes. So far, the federal legislation is stalled. Free speech activists say that these bills could stymie other legitimate uses of deepfakes, like for parody or commentary. They say we already have laws on the books that can be used to go after people who create non-consensual porn. But that doesn't address the bigger concern that people like Hani Farid have about the impact of deepfakes.
I think the more worrisome trend, however, is not the fake content in and of itself. It's the what happens in the world when, if anything can be fake, nothing is real. If more than half of content that we see online is fake, how are we going to distinguish the real from the not real? And I think that's what's more worrisome, is that the ecosystem is going to become so poisoned that nobody's going to be able to believe anything they see, hear, or read online. And in many ways, that is what concerns me more than anything else.
As for Chris Yumi, the deepfake artist from the beginning of this story, he shares Noelle and Hani's concerns. In fact, he didn't want to tell me too much about how he creates deepfakes to avoid making it even easier for bad actors to create their own. But he says that maybe the solution to this whole problem isn't technological or legal. Maybe it's human.
People just have to learn to be more critical. That's the point. They don't have to be scared of deepfake, because It probably existed even before you heard the word deepfake. You just didn't know it. At least now you know it exists, and you know you shouldn't believe what you see.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. We're talking about fakes, what's fake, what's real, and whether and how it makes a difference. Sometimes we have to question what's real or how real something is. Our next story is about a man who grew up in a very tight-knit religious community. Everything he knew about life, or how to live, came from his religious leaders. Outside information was not permitted. The only real world was within the faith. But then a piece of information started to unravel his beliefs. Molly Schwartz brings us this story.
Austin Lanherds Howard grew up as a Jehovah's Witness in a small city outside of Vancouver. And he says it was a bit like being in the movie The Truman Show.
Good morning!
Morning!
Good morning!
Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Where Jim Carrey lives in this fake world that's actually a TV show.
Morning, Truman.
Morning, Spencer.
Hey, Pluto. No. Get down.
He won't hurt you.
Get down.
Yeah, I know.
It felt like everything was too good to be true, perfect to an obnoxious amount, and everything that you did was monitored. Everywhere that you went was monitored. All your conversations were. Most of them felt scripted.
Austin went to public school with the other kids his age, but he was told to keep himself separate from them.
People that I went to school with were worldly people. We were to be no part of this world. so I couldn't be friends with others at school. I ate lunch in the band room by myself, by the tambourines.
Austin knew that there was another world out there, separate from the one that he lived in. He just couldn't be part of it.
We had to wear a specific type of wardrobe. Nothing trendy. If anything was trendy, you couldn't get it. The men had to have specific haircuts, so no facial hair. Your hair had to be shorter. We would have to make sure that everything is looking a certain way because that's the way that Jehovah would want it, and it would glorify God's name. And then on top of that, the things that we were allowed to watch as far as entertainment goes, if it featured any other religion, we weren't allowed to watch it. So Star Wars was a no because it had the Force, and the Force wasn't godlike. Harry Potter was an obvious no.
Instead, Austin read books about his religious community. He read Jehovah's Witness pamphlets and books from his mom's library. He learned that 1975 was a big year in Jehovah's Witness history. This was the year that they had predicted the world was going to end. It was a huge deal.
Something to reach out for, and it just seems it's given all of us so much more energy and power in this final burst of speed for the finish line. And that's the year 1975. As one brother put it, stay alive to 75.
Lots of people joined the Jehovah's Witness Church. Some people even sold their houses and quit their jobs because they thought the world was going to end. Of course, the world didn't end in 1975. This failed prediction didn't look good for Jehovah's Witnesses. Austin knew about the history, but it didn't bother him at first. He accepted that it was just a mistake. But then, in 2017, when Austin was 23 years old, he went to the annual Jehovah's Witness convention, like he did every year. He sat in an auditorium with hundreds of other Jehovah's Witnesses, and a video started to play
and
on the big screen.
When, years later, another test came our way. You see, back then, some were looking to a certain date as signifying the end of this old system of things.
This video was an attempt to address the failed 1975 prediction. The video painted people who thought the world would end in 1975 as not true followers of Jehovah, thereby shifting the blame off of the leaders and onto their followers. Austin knew that the 1975 prediction had come from the very top of the organization. He watched this video and saw bad propaganda.
It felt kind of surreal. I remember being in the crowd and the 1975 video played, and I started looking around kind of in disbelief because I knew that I wasn't the only person that knew about this. There were some people in the crowd that lived through the years of 1975. Everyone else had this happy face, and they clapped at the end of the video, and everyone agreed with it. People had mentioned how much they liked the video.
Austin was stunned. It felt like a glitch in the Matrix. This video put a crack in his faith, and the doubts started pouring in.
It felt like, on top of being alone in the world, now all of a sudden I felt completely alone in my own religion because it seemed like I was the only one that was seeing any of this.
Austin researched other Jehovah's Witness teachings to try to restore his faith, but everything just magnified his doubts. Eventually, he decided that he couldn't be a Jehovah's Witness anymore.
Finding out about all these different things was like stepping out of the skybox for the first time and realizing that you've been living a lie your whole life. Essentially, I was what they called an apostate, and I would lose my family and friends and everything that I knew.
Jehovah's Witnesses have a strict zero-contact policy toward anyone who leaves the church. Austin knew that after leaving, he'd never be allowed to talk to his mom or his sisters again. So he took a week to tell everyone his decision and say his goodbyes.
The conversations I had with my mom and my sisters and my best friends, it was very emotional because it's the last time you're going to talk to them. I cried for days, and it still gets me from time to time. It'll still get me for the rest of my life, most likely.
Getting cut out from such a tight-knit community was traumatic. Austin saw others who left Jehovah's Witnesses suffer from something like PTSD. He knows four people who have died by suicide after leaving. So he's been taking steps to protect his mental health through this transition.
In order to do any of this, I've been going to a therapist while I was trying to fade and trying to get a grip of who I was as a person, because your entire identity is a Jehovah's Witness. So you don't really know who you are as a human being because you're part of a collective.
Austin's moved to another city in Canada. Since leaving the church, he's found new friends and a new kind of family. He recently applied for a master's degree in physics, something he's always loved but wasn't allowed to pursue as a Jehovah's Witness. And he's also started catching up on all those movies he wasn't allowed to watch.
It almost feels like Captain America in his first movie or whatever, when he's coming out of the ice and learning about all of the different pop culture references. So I kind of went on a spree for a while learning about different things like Harry Potter and the TV shows that I missed out on, and just kind of becoming acclimated to society again.
That story was reported by Molly Schwartz. Talking about what's real, what's fake, and when it matters.
Hey, this is Isis. I just wanted to share that I absolutely hate the taste of fake fruit flavors. So like artificial peach, artificial mango. Such a letdown.
Burger King made headlines nationwide when it announced a plant-based Whopper.
Introducing the Impossible Whopper, with a patty made from plants, no beef.
No beef.
I've never had plant taste like beef before.
Tastes like a Whopper.
Tastes like a Whopper.
Tastes like a beef.
Not everybody is on board with this idea.
I have a message for fake meat that wants to be real meat. Don't even try. So you tofu and your seitan and your textured vegetable protein, you do you. You keep it real and you'll do fine.
Now, get ready for this. The next frontier in replicating meat is to grow it in a lab from animal cells. Companies are working on that for human food already, but reporter Alan Yu found that pet food might get there first.
I knock on Shannon Faulkner's door in Philadelphia, and I'm greeted by her two dogs, a Labrador mix called Gaia and a tiny Chihuahua mix called Trot.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Shannon.
I'm going to grab some cookies. And I'll be right back.
All right, cool. Okay, thanks. Once Shannon and I give the dogs some cookies...
Yeah, she's fairly aggressive with cookie taking.
That's okay. They stop barking and let me talk to her.
As a kid, I grew up with three dogs and three cats, and we had a lot of foster pets coming into our house as well. And I was an only child, so my siblings were my pets.
Shannon loves all animals, and she did not like the idea that creatures were being killed to feed her pets. She stopped eating meat a long time ago, but that's not an option for cats and dogs. What could she do for Gaia, Trot, and all the other dogs and cats out there? Shannon became a scientist, got a PhD studying antibiotics. Then she talked to Pat Brown, who used to be a professor of biochemistry at Stanford University.
Yeah, I mean, this man who is this MD, PhD, who had a career that he loved, and he left it all to basically create a veggie burger.
Pat Brown founded Impossible Foods, which is behind Burger King's plant-based Whopper. Shannon was inspired by what he did, so she decided to build on these ideas with pet food. She co-founded a company called Because Animals 3 years ago. They've developed a dog cookie made from nutritional yeast. That's a popular cheese substitute in vegan food. The cookie is for dogs, but it's okay for humans, so I gave it a try.
They're a little dry, but it's just sort of like a...
No, it tastes like fine. I mean, I wouldn't know what this were if you just gave it to me and fed it.
Yeah.
It tastes like a more fibrous Ritz cracker.
It just sort of tastes like a really dry cracker, you know? But the dogs really like them, so that's the important thing.
Their next product is the one Shannon dreamed about. It's a meat product that doesn't involve killing an animal. It's made in a lab from animal cells. So I ask her, is that fake meat?
From my perspective, I don't see anything fake about it, because it does, it is meat, right? It's just that we just didn't have an animal grow the meat. Genetically, it is identical. It's the same DNA that came from an animal. What's fake? What's fake about it?
It's not ready for market yet, but they showed us how they make their product in a lab near Toronto.
I put lab gloves on. I sterilize with ethanol, making sure that I'm not bringing any pathogens.
Our guide is Taylor Brooks, lead tissue scientist for the company. He's harvesting mouse cells to make meat for cats.
So in this particular flask, this is a cell line derived from the muscle of a mouse.
They take this cell and use it to grow mouse muscles in a nutrient-rich soup in a petri dish. They have to be very careful things don't get contaminated because bacteria love that nutrient broth too. Taylor picks up a cell scraper, which looks like a little rake from a tabletop Zen garden.
I'm just trying to collect all of the available biomass. So we can collect this and harvest it into a cat treat.
What Taylor collected is real mouse muscle tissue grown outside of a mouse. The team takes this tissue and makes small meatballs. They've already fed this to a few cats. The next step is to make the process cheaper and more efficient, so the company can grow a lot more to sell on a large scale. For context, the people who made the first lab-grown burger for humans said one of those would cost $50. Shannon acknowledges feeding our pets meat from a petri dish might sound a little strange.
I know people sort of think it's some kind of Frankenstein thing. There's not a doubt in my mind that this won't be the way of the future.
But what do other pet owners think? I went to a dog park in my neighborhood and asked people who were out walking their dogs. Would they feed their dog meat that was grown in a lab?
This dog will literally eat anything.
Others weren't so sure.
I've tried like chicken sort of replacements and they make me ill. And I honestly think a part of it is because they have to, in order to create those sorts of foods, they have to add a lot of extra things into them that are not necessarily organic or not always healthy.
Humans have moved more towards natural food. And so it would be hard to accept them moving towards petri dish created food for our dogs.
I brought their concerns to Shannon.
I'm actually quite pleased that nobody was, so I didn't actually perceive any of those reactions as being negative. There were a couple of folks hesitated a little bit, and it would be weird if nobody hesitated.
Now, as to the woman who wondered whether lab-grown meat is natural, Shannon says that's an interesting question.
There's nothing natural about pet food as it exists right now. Nothing. The only reason why we feed cats chicken or beef or fish is because, again, it's byproducts. In the wild, cats eat mice, small birds, and insects.
She points out that the most common food allergens for cats and dogs are, in fact, beef and dairy products.
For us, by creating a food, a mouse tissue for cats, this is arguably much more natural than the beef that a feral cat is never going to take down a cow in the wild.
Two animal welfare scientists wrote a journal article about vegetarian diets for cats and dogs, and they went a little further. They wrote that pet owners, quote, frequently microchip, vaccinate, deworm, deflea, and desex their animal companions and confine them indoors at night. Clearly, such owners are willing to depart quite radically from naturalness when they believe it may protect the health and welfare of their pets, end quote. Now, be that as it may, there are of course owners who want to feed their pets meat from a dead animal. And there's a thriving business around marketing cat and dog food that will be fit for a wolf or tiger. The packaging features the gleaming eyes of hungry carnivores. But animal scientist Ryan Yamka says wolves will actually happily eat berries and figs.
Wolves, like dogs or any others, they don't necessarily seek out meat. They're opportunistic feeders, and so they also forage as well.
Ryan is an advisor for Bond Pet Foods, another pet food startup that wants to take animals out of the supply chain, though he's not paid for it. He says wolves and dogs and cats actually don't care about what kind of meat they're eating. It's just a vehicle for nutrients.
They're not focused on protein. They're actually focused on amino acids. And so in the case of a dog, if I could supply the proper amount of amino acids and it's digestible and bioavailable to that dog, that dog's body doesn't care if it came from soy or chicken or it came from a cultured protein or algae or duckweed or, you know, crickets.
Consumer attitudes aside, lab-grown meat could become a reality for pets much quicker than for humans. Big players are paying attention and getting involved. Purina, the second biggest pet food company in the world, gave the company that Ryan consults for a $10,000 innovation prize. And chances are, pets won't even notice the change.
That was Alan Yu reporting. Sarah Melton contributed to this report. When you're making meat in the lab from animal cells, what's fake about it? That's what we just heard. But to many people, it would still feel fake, right?
Is it real? Is it fake? Is it real? Is it fake?
Maybe fake is more of a spectrum. Historian Lydia Pine has a new book called Genuine Fakes.
I wanted to encourage readers to think about, well, what happens if it would occupy that middle? What if it was both?
Fakes involve deception, but when you take that away, then you're talking about something different that could be really valuable.
Replicas of heritage sites, for example, can really help mitigate the effects of mass tourism. I think that copies can sometimes offer ethical alternatives. I think that models can help communicate information, perhaps even better than their originals or their real counterparts. And so one of the things that I've come to understand about fakes is that they're complicated, but also that they can serve cultural purposes as well.
Lots of places around the world are trying to create replicas of archaeological sites. Sometimes
yes.
You go into a natural history museum and you see a big dinosaur and you're like, oh, wow, this is amazing.
Right.
And then you realize, oh, no, it's a copy or it's a fake. So what's your take on that? Is that a good idea or will that make people feel like I didn't really see this?
Yeah, I think the difference that you've highlighted here is exactly sort of what the concern is. Is building a replica and sort of having tourists go through a replica, is that just sort of almost Disneyifying history in some way, that it's, you know, it's for entertainment or something like that? And, you know, how real is it? And I think that replicas of heritage and archaeological sites are sort of changing in the last couple of decades and are sort of coming into their own and being more and more acceptable as stand-ins and as ways of sort of protecting archaeological sites and also sort of as being able to convey information and knowledge to people who are going through them.
For example, think about the famous Paleolithic cave paintings in France, some of humanity's earliest artwork. So many tourists went through there.
It had introduced bacteria, that it had introduced all of these problems to the point where the paintings were being destroyed.
And with that realization, replica caves became more acceptable.
And one of the interesting sites with that is a site in France called Chauvet Cave. It's another famous site with great cave paintings, rhinoceroses, horses, all of these sorts of things, lions. And the replica of Chauvet Cave has actually become so closely tied with the identity of the original that in the UNESCO sort of protections and the UNESCO listing, the replica is considered part of the cave.
But one thing I think we want to feel when we go into a site like that is we want to feel the connection with all the humans that have come before us. And when you're in a space that is, quote, the original space, you can feel that connection with the generations and generations of people that have come before you, and you're truly in that same space.
Right.
Do you miss out on that feeling?
One of the things that replicas like Chauvet Cave has done is to simulate that feeling as much as possible. So it sits at the same temperature. It has a similar humidity. It has sort of all of the ways, all of the sensory ways that you would experience going to see the original. You're absolutely correct, however, that it's not, quote unquote, the same. I mean, there are no emergency fire exits in the original cave or, you know, things like that. It's not the original. And maybe the sort of cultural point that we need to get to is to say, and that's okay. There's still value in the replica, and the replica can still offer a sensory experience.
Lydia Pine is a historian. Her new book is called Genuine Fakes. When it comes to laughter, there's the real deal, like when you cannot control yourself, you can't stop laughing. And then there's this. Somebody makes a joke, maybe it's your boss or your brother-in-law, and you don't think it's funny at all, but you laugh anyway because it just seems like the polite thing to do. What's going on when we fake a laugh? Reporter Susie Armitage takes us to a comedy show.
When it's comedy open mic night on a Tuesday in a small bar, chances are almost everybody in the audience is here to perform rather than take in the show. And tonight, at Pete's Candy Store in Brooklyn, I'm sitting right by the stage, not here to record the jokes, but to catch the laughs, the big ones.
He's been talking about it all day.
The small ones. And the kind of laughter that you could describe as polite.
You know, like imagine that. You can go up in front of an audience and make them laugh, and you're not even funny. It's the dream.
I point my microphone at the comedians, and then I turn it back towards the crowd to record the laughter. This becomes a barometer for how well a joke landed. And then it becomes the joke itself.
She didn't even move the mic this time.
In the comedy world, laughter is currency. So comedians have developed a finely tuned ear for all the different kinds of laughter out there. Here's Sam Zelich, or Sam Z, the host of this open mic.
You really start to know, oh, that's a pity laugh. Oh, that's a belly laugh. Oh, that person really likes this joke in the back there. You get like a really good sense of the emotional connection because that's ultimately what laughter is. You're judging what the audience is communicating to you through laughter.
For comedians, the stakes of reading that communication accurately are high. If you make people bust out in uncontrollable belly laughter, they say you killed. But then there's the other side of the spectrum. You go out there, all alone under the bright lights, and nobody even chuckles. Comedians call that bombing, and it feels awful.
Time stops, and you start to feel like a very small creature in a world full of giant mammals that are chasing you down and eating you.
Of course, comedians aren't the only ones reading laughter. We're all doing it all the time, trying to figure out if the person we're on a date with or the new coworker we just met is laughing at that thing we said because they really think it's funny or if they're just being nice. And the way Sam described how it feels to bomb on stage, like being an animal under attack, hints at why.
I think one of the reasons that we're good at distinguishing between these laughter types is because it's important to know what exactly people are communicating. In ancestral human environments, assessing who is in your alliance or who is in your group and who is not is a really important thing to do.
Greg Bryant is an evolutionary psychologist who studies vocal communication at UCLA. He says laughter is one cue that can help us figure out who we can trust. For example, a fake laugh could signal that someone's trying to manipulate you. He's done research on the differences between real and fake laughter and our perceptions of it. You try it. Here's laugh A, and here's laugh B. Which one's real, and which one's fake? If you think laugh B is the real one, you're correct, and laugh A is fake. In Greg's study, which included participants from 21 societies around the world, people got it right 56 to 69% of the time. This cross-cultural research found that people living in more tightly knit, less industrialized societies were generally better at picking out the fakes. One possible reason could be that in places where you're more dependent on the people around you, it's more important to know what someone is really thinking or feeling. Greg's research also found that people are more likely to be fooled by a fake laugh when the recording is sped up. Here's that fake you heard, now faster. And when the recordings are slowed down, things get a little weird. Here's what a real laugh sounds like in slow motion. If you didn't know what you were listening to, you might not even be able to tell that sound came from a human being. When people heard these slowed down recordings of real laughter, they only identified it as human about 50% of the time. That's because a genuine laugh is produced by our emotional vocal system. It's the same part of the brain that makes us cry when we're sad or scream when we're hurt or scared. These spontaneous vocalizations are controlled by different mechanisms than the ones that allow us to speak and to fake a laugh. Our peals of laughter likely evolved from the vocalizations our primate ancestors made during play. I asked Robert Provine, a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, who wrote a book on the science of laughter, about how animals laugh.
If you tickle a chimpanzee, and I've tickled a few chimpanzees in my day, I'll give you an example of chimpanzee laughter. Sounds like a panting dog.
He broke down what's going on in the chimpanzee's body.
The chimpanzee is producing the laugh sounds by producing one pant-like vocalization per inward and outward breath. For example, this is unlike the human laugh, where basically we chop an outward breath, just as I'm talking to you now. I'm chopping an outward breath. Chimpanzees can't do that. They can't modulate an outward breath to produce complicated speech-like sounds.
So that's why chimps can't fake a laugh around the water cooler when the boss chimpanzee makes a bad joke. They're missing that particular communication tool. But we have it, and it comes from the same place we produce speech. Here's Greg Bryant again.
Only one system can control your vocal apparatus at a time. So if you're genuinely laughing or you're genuinely crying, you're going to be unable to speak. Whereas if you're laughing volitionally, you can inject that into your speech. So you can laugh while you're producing words. The hallmark of a fake laugh is that there's speech happening at the same time.
And that's why fake laughs sound more like speech if you listen carefully, especially when they're slowed down.
So, for example, they'll have more vowels in them. So the classic fake laugh is like ha, 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 where it's almost all vowels.
There are a few other ways to suss out a fake laugh.
They are generally not as loud as a real laugh. They are slower than real laughs. And they are generally lower pitched because they are not associated with actual emotional arousal.
Well, we may be on the lookout for fake laughs. That doesn't mean they're all deceptive.
I could sort of laugh to indicate that it is your turn to talk now, or that I understand what you just said, and I recognize that it's humorous, but I'm not actually genuinely triggered to laugh spontaneously.
Of course, comedians like Sam aren't looking for these functional laughs, or polite ones. They're going for the real thing, that good, solid belly laugh that means you killed. In his 5 years of doing stand-up comedy in New York, Sam says he's gotten it once.
It's what you chase after forever. I mean, that's the drug. That's the first taste of paradise in a long succession of chasing after and finding hell.
The Muppets, man.
Okay.
That story was reported by Susie Armitage. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jet Slayman, and Steph Yin. We have production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.